thanks for the very nice introduction. You are right. I am optimistic. And the books reflected that. In the case of the U.S. Nicaraguan book, the first edition of that, called Condemned to Repetition, surveyed the history of U.S. Nicaraguan relations, and that history is a tragic history. And it was particularly tragic for me because I was on the National Security Council during the Sandinista Revolution. And we met 25 times in the National Security Council to try to find a path towards a peaceful, democratic exit, both for Somoza and as an alternative to a violent revolution by the Sandinistas. And at the end of that 25 times, we had about as much effect as a small Californian group who arrived in Managua at the height of the revolution and began a process of 2 weeks of transcendental meditation to heal Nicaragua. So that sobered me that this group had just about as much influence on developments as the United States government at the time. And the last third of that book tried to understand why Nicaragua had such a tragic history, why the United States was condemned to repeat many of the mistakes that it had made with respect to Cuba. And I laid out a scenario at the end about how to exit that tragedy by trying to mediate a democratic election. This book was published at the height of the Iran-Contra scandals, and indeed the last draft was done as Oliver North was testifying. You may not recall, but Oliver North actually had a profound effect for about 1 month on public opinion towards the Contras, because he was the first one to make a powerful case in the media on it, and all of a sudden, public opinion, which had been against the Contras in the U.S., shifted in favor. And it was at that very moment that I had to revise the galleys, and I had to guess to myself, this is going to be a temporary blip, and that Oliver North and the Contras will go away, and this is wrong, and the right path is this democratic exit. And fortunately, that proved to be the case. 1 year later, I was invited to Nicaragua by the Sandinistas to celebrate the 10th anniversary of their revolution, as was Carter. He asked me to go in his stead. And while there, I was able to persuade both Daniel Ortega and Violeta Chamorro to invite the Carter Center to observe the elections with unrestricted access to all stages of the process. And that, I must say, the 6-8 months that followed were the most rewarding experience of my professional life. Because at that moment, I think it's safe to say that no one in Nicaragua was a Democrat. But by the end of that time, I think they all had begun to understand what that means. And to accept when Carter finally posed the question to Violeta Chamorro and Daniel Ortega on the eve of the election, will you accept the result if you lose, if it is a free and fair election? And both sides said yes, and in the end they did. And they got there because of a technique of election mediation, which sprung from Carter's skills and our strategy, in which all sides bought in to a process of democracy, which had never occurred before in Nicaragua. That, of course, is not the subject of my discussion today. Dane provoked me by reminding you of one of my most recent books. The subject of my discussion today is North America, a subject that one would not have contemplated 15 years ago, least of all in presenting it before a forum on Latin America. North America 15 years ago was little more than a geographical expression. 5 decades ago, when the Europeans got together in Rome and signed the Treaty of Rome, all of the members declared that they would lay the foundation of an ever closer union among the peoples of Europe. That was the origin of the European Union. In comparison, if you read the preamble of the North American Free Trade Agreement, which was negotiated and signed in 1992 and came into effect on January 1st, 1994, it reads as if it had been written by Lily Tomlin, the comedian who once said, "Together we are in this alone," because that's where NAFTA emerged from. It emerged from three countries that for two centuries had tried to find a way to limit their friendship, as Jorge Castañeda and myself wrote, to keep distance from each other for different reasons. Canada and Mexico, because of deep-seated fears of the overwhelming power of the United States in between. Mexico, additionally, because it preserved the autonomy and the strength of the PRI, which didn't want any interference in Mexico or in their own control of political affairs within Mexico. Canada, because it felt vulnerable as a nation of just 32 million people on the periphery of the United States. The United States, because it thought of itself in the 20th century as a global power, not as a continental power, and therefore seeking any closer relationship other than one based on friendly relations with its two neighbors, not something that most Americans even contemplated. And when you look closely at the debate that occurred when the North American Free Trade Agreement was put before the parliaments of all three countries, it brought out, as the debate on immigration, I believe, will soon in the United States again, many of the deep-seated fears of all three countries. Canada and Mexico, again, of being suffocated or overwhelmed by the United States. The United States of being overrun by Mexican immigrants or being deindustrialized by U.S. corporations who would flee south to the cheaper labor of Mexico. That great sucking sound, as Ross Perot referred to it during the debate on NAFTA. But the agreement itself was quite simple. It did not have, as I suggested a moment ago, the vision of what North America could be. It was simply a business contract aimed to dismantle trade and investment barriers over a decade, with some barriers existing over 15 years. In addition to this basic agreement, there were two side agreements that Bill Clinton negotiated on labor and the environment, mostly for political reasons to try to neutralize some of the opposition to NAFTA. That was essentially the agreement. How well did it do? If you define the agreement in the terms in which I just defined it, it was a great success. By and large, trade and investment barriers were dismantled. There has been a problem of compliance with regard to several very prominent sectors, such as softwood lumber with respect to Canada, sugar and trucking with regard to Mexico. But by and large, all parties had complied with the agreement. And trade investment barriers declined, and trade almost tripled in a decade. Investment more than tripled in a decade. So from the simple perspective of the principal objectives, one would say NAFTA was a success. And indeed, if you follow the doctrine of Yogi Berra, who once said you can see a lot just by looking, if you look at North America a decade after NAFTA, it has become a region. Indeed, it is the largest and most formidable free trade area in the world in terms of gross product and in terms of territory, larger than that of the European Union. It has become a very formidable trading area in addition to that. In terms of integration, if you define integration as intra-regional trade as a proportion of global trade, then U.S., Mexico, and Canada's intra-regional trade went from less than one-third of its global trade two decades ago to nearly 61% today. That means 61% of the trade that all three countries have with the world is with each other, which is roughly where the European Union is after five decades. So that's a degree of economic integration that is quite astonishing to have achieved in such a short period of time. Beyond that, in terms of social integration, one-third of all of the foreign-born population in the United States today were born in Mexico. Every single year, nearly 500 million people or 500 million crossings occur between the U.S., Mexican, and Canadian borders, roughly 300 million, almost 1 million a day between the U.S. and Mexico, and 200 million between the U.S. and Canada. So the degree of economic and social integration has been quite profound. Large firms in all three countries have become North American, no longer U.S., Canadian, Mexican operations, but North American operations. So social and economic integration has proceeded quite intensively over the last decade among the three countries. But that doesn't detract from the single characteristic that continues to define the three countries, which is asymmetry, unevenness, imbalance. The United States still makes up almost 90% of the gross product of the three countries of North America. The Mexico and Canada depend on the U.S. market for almost 90% of all of their trade, whereas the United States only depends on 36% of its trade with its two neighbors. But having said that, this does not mean that the U.S. is not dependent on its neighbors. The first and second largest trading partners of the United States are Canada and Mexico. The first and second largest source of energy imports into the United States are Canada and Mexico, not Venezuela, not Saudi Arabia. The United States exports twice as much to Canada and Mexico as it does to the European Union 25 members. It exports four times more to Canada and Mexico than it does to China and Japan. This would be hard for many people to realize. If you read the newspapers, you think that China is our number one trading power today. But the truth is that we export four times more to our two neighbors than we do to China and Japan. So whereas there is still asymmetry, imbalance in our trade between our two neighbors and ourselves, we are now far more dependent on our two neighbors than most Americans realize, economically and socially, and from a perspective of energy as well. North America, in short, is no longer simply a geographical expression. It's the most formidable free trade area in the world today. Now, having said that, let's review now once again NAFTA. The deep-seated fears that the three countries had of each other did not turn out to be true. The United States, the fear that Ross Perot had of losing jobs occurred in the 1990s. The United States had the greatest job expansion in its history. And while one cannot attribute that wholly or even mostly to NAFTA, it's clear that NAFTA did not lead to the deindustrialization of the United States, that there are larger forces at work in the transformation of the American economy. From the Mexican and Canadian perspective, that feared the overrun of U.S. companies buying up. In fact, in Canada's case, Canada invested more foreign investment in the United States since NAFTA than the U.S. invested in Canada. And the share of U.S. investment in Mexico was reduced since NAFTA came into place, even while the total amount of foreign direct investment in Mexico increased from an annual rate of about $1.5 billion to nearly $13.5 billion. Mexico actually became the biggest trading power in Latin America by far. Two decades ago, it trailed Brazil. Now it trades almost twice as much as Brazil. It's half of all of the trading power in Latin America is in Mexico. Indeed, 90% of all of the trade and the gross product of the Americas is in North America today, reflecting the further fragmenting of the Americas. Though our leaders are going down to Argentina for the Summit of the Americas, the truth is that the pillar of the summit, the free trade area of the Americas, is probably dead. Rhetoric aside, the Americas have broken into different regional trading blocks, of which North America is far and away the most important trading block. The others actually have disintegrated, not integrated, over the last 15 years. A smaller percentage of their trade today in Mercosur, in the Andean Pact, in Central America, and in Caribbean is with each other than with the rest of the world than it was 15 years ago, and that percentage is already quite low. So the only really vigorous free trade area in the world today, or in the Americas today, is in North America. Now, having said that, however, that doesn't mean NAFTA has been a great success. Indeed, many of the old arguments are still very much alive. But I would argue it's not because of what NAFTA is or was supposed to be. NAFTA's greatest failure is what was omitted, what was left out, because we had to overcome two centuries of wanting to distance ourselves. There was no real effort to address the largest questions in North America, and indeed, it's those questions which make up the agenda for North America in the second decade. Indeed, I would say that the debate on NAFTA should be over. The debate on North America should now begin. And that should begin based on what NAFTA did not do. What didn't it do? The first and most important question it failed to address is the development gap between Mexico and its two northern neighbors. And that development gap has not only not narrowed, it has widened. And by doing so, it has not only disillusioned many in Mexico, but throughout the developing world. One of the reasons that CAFTA was so difficult to get passed, one of the reasons why the free trade of the Americas cannot flourish, is because people don't see clearly that free trade is the path towards modernization that many people had expected. So that's the first question. Is what to do about the development gap. Because unless and until Mexico can find its path towards the first world, other trading arrangements will be impugned. The second question unanswered was immigration. There were some who argued that NAFTA would lead to a reduction in immigration, but in fact it's led to a dramatic increase in illegal as well as legal migration. And that's in part because while there was no explicit development strategy in NAFTA, there was an implicit one. And that implicit one was by dismantling trade investment barriers, it in effect encouraged foreign investors, 90% of them, to go into the northern part of Mexico, which was already connected by transportation to the United States and to Canada. And therefore, jobs were created at a very rapid rate in the northern part of Mexico, and that served as a magnet for labor coming from the center and the south. And once those workers came from the center and the south, the turnover rate on the border was 100% in 1 year, because having come there, they learned all they need to do is find a way across the border, and their income can increase by a factor of 10, sometimes 30. So people did not come to the United States seeking jobs. They came seeking higher income. And as long as that income gap exists as wide as it does, they will continue to come there. The great irony, therefore, of NAFTA was that while its proponents argued it would reduce migration, the implicit development strategy encourages migration. The third question beyond the lack of a development plan and a lack of addressing the issues of immigration is NAFTA failed to plan for possible externalities, for possible market failures. We created a continental market, and yet we didn't anticipate that that continental market would create some problems. The first and most obvious and the most glaring became known as the peso crisis, where a large flow of capital flooded into Mexico at the beginning of NAFTA, the first year, in January of 1994, and it flooded out at the end of the year and took and siphoned off about 6% of the Mexican economy in a matter of weeks. Not only angering and enraging and setting backwards Mexican wages, but disillusioning those in the United States that thought that this would be a great panacea. So we didn't plan for that. There was no macroeconomic policy coordination. The central banks, the ministers of finance, did not communicate with each other. Indeed, on the day that the peso crisis started, the newly appointed Secretary of the Treasury, Bob Rubin, was on vacation in the Caribbean, and he was quoted by the New York Times as saying, well, let the market sort it out. A month later, he realized that that was a mistaken answer. He should have known better, since he was head of the National Economic Council in the White House, whose job was to anticipate crises such as occurred. Besides failing to plan for market failures, we also failed to plan for the success of NAFTA. Because while trade increased 3 times, we did not plan at all to cope with that additional success. And so therefore you have 3 times as many trucks coming to the borders with no change in the infrastructure. Therefore, clogging up those arteries at the very border, increasing the costs of trade as a result of transaction costs and lack of infrastructure and bureaucratic delays, above that of the tariffs that were eliminated as a result of NAFTA. What else did NAFTA not do? It also was silent on security until we heard this great burst in 9/11. Then you saw the beginning of a huge speed bump on this way to Tom Friedman's flat earth. It's called security on the border to protect everyone from global terrorism, again wiping out many of the gains of integration. The other, and I'd say the biggest mistake of NAFTA, was that in our desire to be different and better than Europe, a desire that really goes back at least to the Monroe Doctrine, if not to our Declaration of Independence, and holds for our Canadian and Mexican neighbors to a certain extent, we made the opposite mistake of Europe. Europe over-institutionalized, created supranational, intrusive, huge bureaucracies. We created almost none. There are no North American institutions. And what does that mean? It means that, for example, on September 12th, if you'd had an institution of consultation among the three leaders, all three leaders should have met in the Rose Garden that day and said, the attack of September 11th was not just attack on New York and Washington, it was attack on North America. We treat it as an attack on North America, and we're determined to forge a unified response. In the absence of new institutions, all three countries reverted to traditional habits. The U.S., traditionally, as it always does, reverted to its unilateralism, virtually by itself closing the two borders with dramatic and devastating economic consequences for Canada and Mexico, closing down 11 plants that required just-in-time production in Canada. And had a similar effect on Mexico. And Mexico and Canada reverted to their traditional ambivalence when dealing with the enraged elephant in between. The first thing you want to do is get out of the way of the elephant. You don't want to jump on top and cheer it forward. You just want to make sure it doesn't stomp you. And that's the traditional way in which we deal with each other. More deliberately, there is not a North America. There are two bilateral relationships, U.S.-Canada and U.S.-Mexico. There is not an attempt of all three countries to come together to forge rules on what this North America should look like. And that gets to the absence of the vision. There is no sense in NAFTA. There has been no real articulation by our leaders as to what North America should be, what it should do. So that brings us now to Professor Lipson's entrance and to the part in which he obviously wanted. He didn't want to hear the analysis. Professor Lipson just wants now to hear the prescription. And that's where we'll go to next. If we have a chance to do it again, or more importantly, to design the agenda for North America for the second decade, what should it look like? I think it needs to start with a vision, with a design. What should North America look like in the future? Should it be an entity of some form that still preserves the sovereignty of three countries? How should we look at each other? I would say that vision should be based on a community. And a community is a neighborhood in which everybody feels that they have a stake in each other's success and can be harmed by each other's setbacks. It means that if the house of your neighbors is renovated and the value improves, that improves the value of your house. If the house of your neighbor is vulnerable to crime or burns down, that's going to hurt your house. And therefore, you need to find ways to make sure that everybody is lifted, because it helps you, and that nobody is set backwards because it hurts you. If Mexico grows faster than we do, 90% of their imports come from the United States, our second largest trading partner. There is no other single way to stimulate the U.S. economy as fast as it would be to help stimulate the Mexican economy. If Mexico has another peso crisis, if it's set back by political instability, there's no containing the consequences for the United States. People will rush to the borders, and while immigrants are a contribution to the United States, large, massive, immediate flows lead to social dislocations with consequences about how the United States looks at Mexico and looks at its own people. So a community relies on us thinking about our neighbors in very different ways than the U.S., Canada, and Mexico have thought to each other in the past. A community also means that if we can show that Mexico can grow through North American Free Trade Agreement, then everybody will want to board the free trade train. Everybody wants off right now because they're aware that free trade is not sufficient, that there is something more that needs to be done to lift countries that join free trade agreements to develop further. If we can find a way to establish a real community, then we can also deal with the security challenge of 9/11. And that means that that in looking at terrorism in the future, instead of looking at our two neighbors as potential source of enemies, we look at them as partners. Instead of looking at the classic trade-off between security and economic integration, we can find a way to transcend that trade-off, and that there are ways to do that. And finally, a community has the additional benefit is it stretches America. America is a remarkable country. It's the most international and the most insular at the same time. I mean, we are a country that are made up of 190 other countries, and yet it amazes me continually how we're unable to think outside of our bounds. I just directed a commission on federal election reform that was chaired by Jimmy Carter and James Baker. And we did a study of the various states. As you know from the introduction, I helped organize observation of elections all over the world. Well, in starting in 92 and completing in 2004, I've also organized the observation of U.S. elections. First thing that you need to know is that there is only one of 50 states that permits the international observation of U.S. elections. We have insisted all over the world, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Liberia, in Palestine, in Nicaragua, in Panama, that all countries open themselves to unrestricted electoral access to observers all over the world. And yet we don't let them in to the United States at all. When I wrote to the Secretaries of State of Maryland and Virginia and asked for credentials to permit international observers, the answer was, I'm afraid we don't do this. When I protested, they said, all right, we will identify two designated sites for you to visit. I said, no, no, that's not how election observation works. We call them internationally Potemkin polling sites when you designate the sites. You need to give observers the chance to see everywhere. Oh, no, we're not going to let this do. So I went all the way up to the top in Virginia, and when I finished this conversation, the woman said to me, well, you should know, actually, that I just said the same thing to Colin Powell. I said, well, that doesn't make me feel better, if that's what you want. So one of the recommendations of our report, which I will be talking about tomorrow at 3 p.m., by the way, is unrestricted access to all stages of the electoral process in the United States for domestic and international observers that are responsible and that won't interfere in the electoral process but are there to observe. So what do we need? Why do we need a North American community? We need it because we need to think about ourselves in larger ways. We need to understand that everything we impose on the world, we should be prepared to accept ourselves. Now, specifically what needs to be done to translate this vision into a set of policies and institutions. I think, first of all, we need to move towards a customs union, a common external tariff. Why? Because of 9/11, because of the rules of origin, in effect, what was originally designed to be a free trade area actually has created a lot more impediments. So many impediments that a lot of companies don't even use the NAFTA tariffs. They use MFN tariffs. The transaction costs actually have increased so high as a result of a number of factors right now that it has almost eliminated the advantage of NAFTA. And the only way you do that is you have to move towards a common external tariff. You eliminate customs on the borders, and you permit our people on the borders to focus on terrorism and immigration or drugs, not on all of the goods. It permits a deeper integration. Secondly, we need to forge a common security perimeter. If you want to secure the United States against terrorism, we need to make sure that Mexico and Canada are secure too. And we need to work with them to make sure that the border doesn't get clogged. And there's several ways you can do that. You can move to a common exclusion list. You can move to a common personnel, security personnel, customs and immigration personnel that man all of the perimeter of North America. It doesn't mean leaving aside the two borders, U.S.-Mexico and U.S.-Canada. It just means placing greater emphasis on common approaches to security among the three countries. Thirdly, we need to think about North American policies. We need to think about a North American plan on transportation and infrastructure. If we're going to integrate the economies, we need to build new corridors that connect our three countries much better. We need to build better highways. We need to build it as part of a plan. The United States just passed a transportation bill a few months ago, allocating $286 billion for transportation and infrastructure. Of that, the percentage allocated for integration in North America for the borders was roughly 0.003%. We are not thinking of ourselves as North America. We're not thinking about the trade that is so important to all of North America. We need to. We need to think about North American plans for education. We have a Center for North American Studies at American University. I'd love to see 20 centers in each of the three countries. We have Title VI in our National Defense Education Act. That doesn't involve North America. It involves centers for Latin America, centers for Asia, centers for Africa, centers for Eastern Europe, for the Middle East, but not North America. We're not thinking about ourselves in terms of North America. We bring more students in from China and India each year by a factor of about 10 than we bring from Canada and Mexico, and the same applies for students going out as well. We need to think about ourselves within a different context in North America. To do that, we also need to think about how do we address the development gap. And there I have a very specific proposal, which fortunately now has been introduced as a bill in Congress by a Republican senator from Texas, called North American Investment Fund. And this North American Investment Fund builds on lessons to be drawn from the European Union's regional and cohesion policies. At the very beginning of the European Union in 1957, they said, a community of nations requires that we reduce disparities between rich and poor countries. It took them several decades, a lot of experiments, but they found a way to do it. Now, of course, great macroeconomists in the United States believe free trade areas lead to a convergence in incomes. And the U.S. is a good example of how that happened. After the Civil War, the disparity between the North and South of the United States was absolutely huge. We had a free trade area, single monetary union, and sure enough, those income disparities have been significantly narrowed. Unfortunately, it took 110 years, and the gap between the North and South was not as large as it is between Mexico and the United States and Canada, and therefore we need to think of another way. We can wait 110 years, or we can do it an alternative way, and the Europeans have figured it out. It wasn't just trade and investment that narrowed the gap between rich and poor nations, and indeed the gap has narrowed in an astonishing way. The four poorest countries of Europe, their average per capita income as a percentage of the European Union average in 1985 was 65%. Today, it's 80%. That is very significant error. Now, how did they do it? They did it because they transferred $500 billion in 15 years. Now, does that mean we have to transfer $500 billion, roughly 2 to 4% of the GDP of the four recipient countries? The answer is no. They wasted about two-thirds of it. But we do need to have a significant fund of $200 billion over a decade that will learn from what the Europeans did wrong as well as what they did right. What they did right is the money that went for infrastructure, connecting the poorer markets to the richer markets, and a slight amount to post-secondary education, largely community colleges in rural areas, had the biggest impact, the biggest jolt. It lifted Spain, Portugal, Greece, and Ireland way up. In the case of Ireland, it went from the second or third poorest country in Europe to the second richest country in Europe. Now, businessmen will say, oh, the reason Ireland did so well is they cut taxes. That's part of it. The other part is the European Union filled up that gap to the tune of $3 to $4 billion a year, building the highways. My wife and I, of course, did a long study of Europe. We went down to the poor areas of Andalusia in Spain. We traveled all around Ireland. We looked all over, and all we saw were great signs of the European Union. I said, look at that. That's paying for our research. I would take a picture of the European Union sign. They built highways. They built communications. They narrowed the gap significantly. But Ireland and Greece are also further proof that it's not just funds, because Ireland grew to the second richest and Greece still is one of the poorest. A lot depends on what the countries do with that funds. And Ireland used it very effectively. And that gets me, therefore, to the proposal, which should be the heart of a North American community. And that proposal is that the United States and Canada put up half of the money, roughly $10 billion a year, the U.S. $9 billion, Canada $1 billion. Mexico puts up the other half, $10 billion a year, through a change in its tax laws that would allow the percentage of its taxes, a percent of GDP, to go from 11%, the lowest of all of the OECD countries, to roughly 18% during a decade. But more than just putting both sides' funds up, it is critical that there is a sense of what each needs to contribute to narrowing the gap. Because it's going to be more than funds. It requires significant reforms on the part of Mexico. reforms on energy, on electricity, on taxes, on labor. These are issues that most Mexicans understand, but they're in a state of political stalemate. If the U.S. and Canada say, look, we want to contribute to reducing this gap, we want you to as well. I personally believe, and indeed I asked the two leading candidates in Mexico for president, whether they would accept the idea of transcending a community of interest by each figuring out how they can contribute significantly to reducing the gap. So that's a North American investment fund. None of these work in the absence of institutions. We don't want to replicate the European Union supranational institutions, but you need something. You need an annual summit of the three leaders, and you need a North American commission or an advisory council that's quasi-independent that can put forth plans, options for North America. Our three governments' purpose is to staff their leaders, not to put forth North American options on transportation, infrastructure, education, the environment, labor. They put forth these plans for the leaders to consider. Beyond that, we should have an interparliamentary group of North American parliamentarians. The U.S. and Canada and the U.S. and Mexico have a separate parliamentary groups, both set up in 1960 and 61. It's time to pull them together. We need a North American permanent court on trade and investment to replace the ad hoc dispute settlement mechanisms and to compel all parties, especially the United States, as it is the only one violating these dispute mechanisms, and to build up precedence in trade and investment. We need a North American Antitrust Commission to replace the trade remedies that are interfering with our trade and to recognize we're dealing with a continental market, and the best way to avoid predatory pricing is at a continental level. We need to reorganize the way in which the U.S. government deals with these issues. Canada and Mexico have no choice. They have to focus on the U.S. They have reorganized their governments to focus on the U.S. The U.S. is not. Today, I met with the director of policy planning this morning to try to help him to understand why his secretary of state keeps getting beaten over the head each time she goes to Canada, why the president has repeatedly failed in improving any relationships between Mexico and Canada, despite their sincere interest in improving relations. It has to do with the organization of the government. We are not organized in the U.S. government to deal with the peculiar nature of the issues in front of us in dealing with North America. I recall the first time I briefed President Bush's National Security Advisor on Latin America, John Maestro, at the beginning of the administration on North American issues. I knew him for a while. He's a career Foreign Service officer. And I said to him, John, you know why you're falling asleep while I'm briefing you on these issues? I'm not falling asleep. This is very interesting. You know, I said, no, you're falling asleep. And here's why. You know how to deal with foreign policy issues. You know exactly who to call in the State Department, but you don't have a clue of who to call in the Justice Department or the Department of Labor or the Agricultural Department. Those are the issues that are defining North American relations. You've got to reorganize. And the simple way to do it is to have a special assistant to the president for North American affairs. An alternative is a state-centric model of an undersecretary, not a deputy assistant secretary, which is currently the case. We need to organize to deal with these differently. Is any of this feasible, or is this just some crazy academic musings by me? Well, at the current time, this can't happen. We have putting up $10 billion or $9 billion a year for a decade for Mexico. You know, there's only one country in the world we do that for. It's Iraq. We'd never do it where it could help us more. That's not the way we usually behave. We have this twin deficit problem. I was just in Mexico talking to two economists. One Mexican economist said, how big is the U.S. current account deficit right now? And the second one said, $700 billion. And the first one said, how much of that is in pesos? And the second economist said, all of them. And in fact, that's right. Each year, America overspends the equivalent of the Mexican economy. So before we tell the Mexicans how to reform their economy, they, despite having a minority government, have kept fiscal balance. So it means that we're unlikely to do this next year, that we have some other problems. But nonetheless, the question we need to ask ourselves is, number one, is this desirable? Is this in our interest? Is this a vision of the future that makes sense for the United States and Mexico and Canada? And I think it does. I think it does because it reflects three different challenges that we all need to face and prevail. The first challenge is primarily Mexico's, but it's shared, and that is the development challenge. The second challenge is primarily Canada's, but shared, and that's international organizations. It's shaping rules and rather than having power determine outcomes in North America. And the third has to do with us and our leadership in the world. Can we lead in the world if we keep telling, as the Canadians and Mexicans tell me they're hearing, this is the way to go, you do it this way, or forget it? I was sitting next to, we had dinner last week with the head of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. Fascinating individual, actually born in Italy. And I don't know how many know that, but the Royal Canadian Mounteds are not just, you know, great for television and Walt Disney, but the truth is they are the equivalent of almost their entire police force. Not only are they the federal police, but 8 out of the 10 provinces, having so much respect for them, have asked them to be their police, and roughly about several thousand municipalities have also asked the Royal Canadian Mounties. Now, he interfaces with the Secretary of Homeland Security, and he's about had it with the United States. He said, look, we're looking for partnership, and all we do is we keep getting told, you've got to do it this way or forget it. And we're a little tired of that. And I think as Americans, we should understand that. We should be prepared to deal with our neighbors in a different way. It's interesting if you look at public opinion, because the American, Canadian, and Mexican publics are actually way ahead of their leaders on this issue. First of all, in the last 2 decades, we've done world value studies and shown that there's a convergence of values among the three countries. Secondly, if you look at trinational perceptions, up until 2 or 3 years ago, each of the three countries respected the other's peoples more than any other countries. We look to Canada most favorably. Mexico has either been 2 or 3, depending on our relations with Britain. And it's true also in the other direction. Though the Mexican and Canadian elites often like to take distance from the United States, the public admire the United States and Americans up until a couple of years ago when those polls started going down. But they'll come back up again because I think there's deep-seated reasons. We deal with each other a lot. And if you ask questions about North American integration, that's where the greatest surprise comes up. 58% of Canadians look at themselves also as North Americans. 69% of Americans do, and 34% of Mexicans. A majority of the public in all three countries are prepared to accept in a decade a North American Union if they could be persuaded it would improve their standard of living, not threaten their culture or their environment. In short, the people of all three countries are very pragmatic. They don't stand on the doctrines of sovereignty that we often hear the governments talk about. And there's also an agreement on NAFTA in all three countries. A plurality believe it has benefited all three countries, and a majority in each of the three countries are convinced it's benefited the others more than them. So that's a neat consensus in all three countries, and it tells you a lot about trade politics as well. So where do we go from here? I think in the short term, you only have a vision such as what I've described, the policies and the institutions, if there is either a crisis and you pull this off the shelf and say we've got to deal with our neighbors in a different way, or if there's real leadership. I don't see the real leadership in any of the three countries right now, not this year, not next year, but all three countries are going to be moving into a political transition. And I hope before too long they begin to articulate it. But it might very well be that Winston Churchill was right on this issue of America as he was on so many other things. He once said that the thing that he likes about Americans most of all is that they always choose the right path. The problem is that it's only after they've exhausted all the other alternatives. Thank you. All right. I've left a few things for you to ask questions on. Actually, can I get the water back there?
Earlier you were talking about one of the failures of NAFTA was market failures and the lack of a coordinated monetary policy. And in your prescription, besides the advisory council, it doesn't seem there's much there that would do that. I mean, are you staying away from any sort of central bank? Or?
No, good. You're really paying good attention. That's the one thing I left out. So I appreciate that. There are three options for North America on monetary issues right now. The one, as it relates to currency issues, the one, option one is de facto dollarization. That is to say, over time, Canada and Mexico are going to use the dollar. In fact, they are, increasingly. There's probably more dollars in the Central Bank of Canada than there are, more American dollars than there are Canadian dollars right now. That's because their trade is so one-sided with the United States, they need to trade in dollars. And the beauty of de facto dollarization is it avoids the challenge of deciding on real dollarization, de jure dollarization, which is the other option. Canadians and Mexicans don't really want to adopt the dollar because it means that they will have less control. There is a third option, and that is coming up with the North American currency. There is an economist in Canada called Grubel who has proposed that we adopt the Amero. The Amero would be the North American currency. In practice, it would be a dollar with another name because everybody would trade in their currencies according to their own economic wealth. And that means that 90% of the Ameros would be the U.S. But it would give it a different name. And instead of being called the Federal Reserve Bank of North America, it would be a North American bank, if you will. In practice, it would probably be based on the same model of the Federal Reserve Bank, with having a reserve branch in Toronto and one in perhaps in Monterrey or in Mexico City. But it would have a slightly different decision-making structure as well. I don't see us moving towards the Amero anytime soon. The United States itself is not even that interested in moving towards de jure dollarization. I think our Treasury departments are very nervous about that. They have not, despite many in Latin America thinking that we're trying to dollarize, they have actually tried to discourage the dollarization of whether it's Ecuador or El Salvador or wherever else, or Argentina, for that matter. They're not at all sure this is a good idea. Now, there are many believe that if you move to a unified currency, that this will have a very profound effect on integration and on trade as well, that it would enhance it considerably. But these are very hard questions. And so I put the currency issues aside for the moment and then only say, don't we need better systems for coordination among our central banks and our finance ministries? And the answer is absolutely. It was a crime that we didn't do it in 1993 and 94, and we paid a huge price for that. We have slightly better coordination today than we had then. We have a small set of reserves assigned for emergencies in North America by the central banks, but they're really trivial. The only thing working for us right now, of course, is both the Canadian and the Mexican currencies are relatively free-floating. So you don't have the problem that you had in 93-94 with regard to Mexico. But certainly a higher degree of coordination is needed than we've seen in the past.
Bob, I really enjoyed what you were saying. It's not only smart and articulate, it's, as I was saying to Margie, it's sensible. But it's also a kind of a vision, not a kind of a vision, it is a vision. And I want to ask you something. You know a lot about politics, and I want to ask you a couple of things about the political base for this. One has to do with constituencies. And I'm going to focus on the U.S., but I'm happy to hear you know a lot about similar constituencies in Mexico and in Canada as well. You, in effect, talked about efficiency gains and a potential, I would say, as a result of that, for business support for some of these. And I want to make sure that I understand that correctly. And I want to also understand to what extent you think Hispanic politics in this country, very important and growing constituency, offers a basis for support for greater integration in that regard. Along the lines of constituencies, it would be helpful, I think, if you could say where you thought, other than governmental inertia, where you thought the opposition lay. Second issue has to do with governmental or diplomatic process. It may be a completely separable issue, but it's part of the political underpinnings. We got NAFTA in part because we first had a U.S.-Canadian trade arrangement, and that induced a lot of interest in Mexico, and it made it a lot more sensible. All of the things you've been talking about have been trilateral from the start. And I wonder if, I wonder if some of the issues you think really, A, should be resolved primarily in bilateral fora, and B, whether even if your goal is trilateral, whether you think the starting place in some cases should be bilateral if you're aiming for that.
Well, that's a good set of questions for the next course. I've had the benefit of not only thinking about these ideas myself and writing my book on Toward North American Community, but also being in several forums where I had to negotiate this. The Task Force on North America, I brought a copy for people who would like it, and anybody else who would like a copy, just let me know. I'd be glad to send them to you. Was a group of about 31 individuals from the three countries, high level. John Manley, Deputy Prime Minister of Canada, Tom DeKino, head of the CEOs of Canada, were the two chairs from Canada. Mexico's Pedro Aspe and Andres Rosenthal, former Deputy Foreign Minister and former Minister of Finance. And in the U.S., it was Bill Weld and me. Bill Weld is a fascinating character. But we had a very high-level group, included Carla Hills and others. And it was fascinating to, we went through, incidentally, this last year, instead of writing a book, I've done 65 drafts of this report and 42 of this report. So it's a different experience. I'm negotiating that. And what I found, and we just came from also a couple of other groups, including a North American forum, 25 leaders from each of the three countries, chaired by George Shultz, Peter Lougheed from Canada, former premier of Alberta, and Pedro Aspe again, and others from Mexico. Business people are not as natural a constituency as one would think. I think they ought to be, but they're really quite narrow in their vision. I've tried to get them to think about the concept of transaction costs as something that they have to put into their product, but that you could take it out, dismantle it, and free them of a lot of those costs. If you didn't have cabotage, if you didn't have all kinds of protection on the borders, if you didn't have delays on the borders, you could produce a product much more cheaply. They internalize these transactions. They don't see that there's a government public policy element there that maybe they ought to be negotiating. I think, frankly, all three business communities are in shock about how to deal with Asia right now. I mean, that's the one item is, what do we do about China? How do we protect ourselves from China? The Chinese don't think about protection right now. They're thinking like we thought 100 years ago. How do we move forward? I mean, I've been working on China. You know, China, China has a plan for every year for the next decade of creating a port in China the size of Long Beach, L.A., our biggest port, every year. Now, I ask myself, well, where are those boats coming to? They're, of course, coming to us. Well, where are they coming to? They're coming to only two ports. They're coming to Tacoma, Washington. They're coming to L.A., Long Beach. Well, what are you going to do with 10 times that quantity? We haven't begun to think like that, and they have. So the business constituency is not so obviously there. Obviously, unions are scared. I think all of North America is somewhat scared. The Hispanic community is not really thinking like this. I've now been through about 15 presidential campaigns and many senatorial campaigns, and they all approach me at the beginning about how do you get the Hispanic vote. And of course, I then tell them we need a Latin American policy. I never tell them that Hispanics don't really care about a Latin American policy. They usually, however, discover it by the end of the campaign that the Hispanic community cares about domestic issues. They don't even care about Americans don't care about Mexico. They care about their families, but they really don't care about Mexico. I try to keep that from these leaders as much as possible, but they do discover it. And unfortunately, so there's not a constituency there as well. Where there is a constituency, interestingly enough, is on the two borders, because they face it a lot. There are 39 states in the U.S. whose major trading partner in the world is with Canada, but not a lot of them understand that. And even in those cases, they protect. Take Hillary Clinton, you know, who you'd think should be far-sighted for dealing with. Oh, no, she's more concerned about dairy farmers in Albany than she is about a North American community. So we're not there yet. And part of the reason is that there's nobody really articulating a broader vision, nobody giving consciousness. If you look at public opinion polls, the people look like they are open to this, but they're also scared. Once we begin the debate on immigration, for example, we're going to see all the worst things coming out. My personal view is that's going to be the moment to sell the North American Investment Fund, because all of the immigration proposals out there are not going to solve the immigration problem. They're actually going to make it worse. They don't want to. That's not their intention. But for the purpose of humanitarian gesture, of finding a way to regularize, legalize, whatever you want to put it, you are also sending out a powerful incentive to people who are, you know, who don't want to wait 20 years around the Mexican embassy, that there's an alternative path there. So it's not going to, there's only one way that you're going to solve the immigration problem, is you got to narrow the development gap between the U.S. and Mexico. It's only one way, and that's going to take time. But if Mexico could grow at twice the rate of the U.S. for a decade, 6% versus 3%, and you could do it with the North American Investment Fund, the perceptions of Mexicans towards themselves and towards the United States, the perception of U.S. towards Mexico would begin to change in very significant ways, and that would affect those patterns over time as well. So the short answer to your question is there is not really a constituency there yet. There is not a sufficient consciousness or awareness of the importance of Canada and Mexico in the U.S. It amazes me. I mean, I've spoken to a lot of audiences when I tell them that our number one and two trading partners are our neighbors. There's, you know, oh, come on. It's China. It's got to be China. Or England. It's nowhere close.
And on the issue of bilateralism versus...
Yeah. Yeah, there it's very interesting. Both the Canadians have been the worst on that. They think they have such a special relationship with the United States, they don't want to invite the Mexicans into it. They can answer the question, which they are preoccupied with, is how do we get the attention of the United States? Of course, they're too patient and they're too civil to break things in a way that would get America's attention, even over softwood lumber. You know, Prime Minister Martin came down to New York 2 weeks ago and gave a speech in which the press immediately called me before I could read the speech and said, Prime Minister Martin threatened to cut off energy if we don't adhere to softwood lumber. I said, really? And he goes, why do you think he did that? I said, well, he's obviously interested in getting the attention of the United States, but do you mind sending me the speech? I'd like to take a look at it. Well, I read through it four times, and I couldn't see that connection at all. It was so indirect. They think of themselves only in my life. I say to them, if you really want to get the attention of the United States, get the Mexicans on your side. because they do have a constituency in the United States that Canadians don't have. The Mexicans under Fox have been much more interested in trying to do it three-way. The U.S. has been under Bush has been, you know, I prefer it bilaterally. They're rhetorically okay. They have the strategic, the security and prosperity partnership, but in practice it remains dual bilateral. Because if you have a short-sighted view of American power, you always want to have only one other guy on the other side of the table. If you have a long-sighted view, as you know Marshall did with the Marshall Plan, and say it's in our interest in the long term for Europe to be united, not for us to be stronger vis-a-vis England and France, then you can construct something different. We don't have that kind of leadership today. I think if you did do that, you would construct a very different relationship, and it would be a relationship based on rules, not by power. A relationship in which there's not a residue of resentment after you negotiate everything from softwood lumber to sugar and whatever else, which is what we have right now. That's why I think trilateralism does not come natural, but it's essential to the community.
Thanks. I mean, you've covered an immense amount of ground in this talk, but I'm going to ask you to slide a little further and talk about CAFTA. I mean, if I understood you correctly, one of your models for what North America might do would, say, follow the path of the ways in which Portugal was integrated into the European Union. Does CAFTA complicate your vision or your model of what a North American community might be?
Of course, but I'm fast on my feet, so I can adapt my vision. I think there are several dimensions to that. Number one is, I really do believe that we should try to move towards North American community first before bringing Central American and Caribbean into it. First, because the European Union has shown when you multiply the number of actors around the table, your capacity to move forward declines very quickly. And your capacity to set the rules that can permit additional steps forward is diminished significantly as well. So I'd like to start with three countries that are as different as these three. If we can come up with rules and institutions that would work there. And secondly, if we can find a formula that will lift Mexico, then it will be relatively easy to lift Central America and the Caribbean. If we can't find it with Mexico, we're not going to find it elsewhere. So that's why I would start with North America. Now, having invested so much of my own career in Central America and the Caribbean, I don't want to exclude them, of course. But I also, one of the lessons I drew from the European Union is don't dissipate resources with multiple objectives and all of which are commendable. That's what the Europeans did consistently, and they wasted a lot. Better to focus your priorities, your attention on making it work, and then you can extrapolate beyond that to Central America and Caribbean. Now, that's one question about how that Central America. The other question is CAFTA itself, the debate. It was the most frustrating experience I've had on Capitol Hill in a long time. I debated in before your junior senator, Barack Obama, Mickey Cantor, the two of us, and Obama. And Mickey Cantor, a special trade representative under Clinton, but a classic Clinton-esque figure, argued against it for political reasons. I said, look, you know, CAFTA is really quite small and trivial from an economic standpoint, from the U.S. standpoint. You're dealing $10 or $15 billion of trade. This is not significant. This will have no effect economically on unions and whatever else. They need it. They want it. Do we turn our backs at this moment of peace and democracy in Central America and the Caribbean? That was my argument, and it didn't prevail among the Democrats. It didn't because I think there's an uneasiness. I think it's had a lot to do with anti-Bush. It had a lot to do with a lot of different concerns. And I think what it really means is that America is stalled right now on trade policy. It's stalled on its on where it is, where it wants to go. I think there is a perception that these free trade agreements only help businesses. There are ways to break that perception, and I would start with North America as a way to change that. But in the short term, that's where we're at right now. I'm glad it passed. I think it will benefit Central America and the DR. Not a lot, but it will. And I think it will also do as it did in Mexico. It will open up some divides. You know, what's really interesting about NAFTA is that you can see that it worked if you disaggregate Mexico. If you look at average wages in Mexico, they didn't improve since NAFTA. But if you look at the northern part of Mexico, the wages increased 10 times faster than the southern part of Mexico. So they averaged out to wash. But it was the northern part of Mexico that became a part of NAFTA. The southern part of Mexico never did. I mean, the great irony of the Zapatistas in 1994 was, and I knew this at the time, is their problem was not NAFTA. Their problem was that NAFTA was never going to reach them. And that's what they need to do. We need to supplement a free trade agreement with an investment fund that will, in effect, connect those parts of the country to the North American market. And you start with Mexico, and then you can continue into Central America. But you don't, in my judgment, try to dissipate it. I think free trade is fine, but it's going to open up gaps also in Central America and the DR, as it often does.
I was very interested in your talking about the sorts of establishing rules and institutions for North America area. I was trying to imagine what a multilateral institution that would be concerned with terrorism policy would look like from either Canada or Mexico. It's hard for me to imagine that looking like anything but a unilateral kind of imposition. Could you comment on that?
Sure. I think that there are alternative ways to do it. I mean, I testified before the parliament in Ottawa right after the birth of the Department of Homeland Security, and I made a stronger case I could. I said, you have an option right now. We are now reorganizing the U.S. government in the most profound way since 1947, when we created the National Security Act and National Security Council and the Pentagon. We are now creating a Department of Homeland Security, which will be, because its mission is to be a fortress. I think you've got to figure out a way to get in that fortress on a concerted basis. You've got to have a transfer of your top people to work there for periods, you know, 3 to 6, 10 years, whatever it is. You've got to put Canada and Mexico in Department of Homeland Security, and if you stay outside, you may develop good relations, as John Manley did with Tom Ridge. Personal relationships will not work. You need to institutionalize it. Now, there are several ways to do it. One is you have what Europeans call a twinning of personnel. You take cohorts of personnel and you move them around in the three countries. And you realize if you're going to have a Department of Homeland Security that's going to be continental in scope, you need to have Canadians and Mexicans in there. Secondly, you need to build a cadre of North American officials that deal with security, that deal with customs, that deal with immigration. Canadians, Mexicans, and Americans all working side by side on the periphery, on the perimeter. Now, that requires a certain leap. I mean, you know, the U.S. personnel, the Bush administration is not there. I've been debating this with people in Homeland Security and State Department and the White House since 2001. They're not there. I don't think they'll ever be there. The question is whether the United States sees the importance of it. And the question also is, how does Canada and Mexico deal with it? They've been dealing with it as best they can. And it's been frustrating. But they have developed new collaborative mechanisms. The Canadians are now renegotiating NORAD to be much more extensive than before. They're trying their best to figure out a way in. But the truth is that they are frustrated, and they do not feel right now that the United States is treating them on an equitable basis, and they're right. It offends my sense of fairness, and I think it will Americans if people can understand it better. Thank you. Great.